Thank you, Dr. Mahler. That's very kind of you. Stephen Brown preached for years at the Key Biscayne Presbyterian Church in South Florida, and he was known for his bluntness and his transparency. There was an older woman in the church who did not appreciate how much he talked about his own failures. And she approached him one day and said, "You know, preacher, we've always had ministers who said that they were sinners, but you're the first one we've believed." If you heard my talk last hour, it was entitled Lessons I've Learned from Mistakes That I've Made. And you probably, those of you who are there, probably think I'm a total buffoon. And you're probably right. If you weren't there, I talked about learning lessons to confront and to delegate and to make the family priority and to be content regardless of statistics. But I learned those lessons because of some horrendously embarrassing mistakes that I made along the way. So this hour, I thought I would talk about some things I did right in ministry. And I hope that this will not sound like I'm boastful, but I'd like to talk about some leadership lessons I learned from positive decisions that I made. And I hope that it will be helpful to you, even though my experience of leadership is totally as a local pastor, that you can transfer the principles to your sphere of influence, wherever that may be. 1 Corinthians 1:11 or 11:1, Paul said, "Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ." So I'm going to mention three conscious decisions I made that I think are worth following. The first is, I did not get caught up in the celebrity mentality. I avoided getting caught up in the celebrity mentality. Romans 12, verse 3 says, "Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the measure of faith God has given you." If you lead a successful organization, it's easy to begin to think more highly of yourself than you ought. Being a leader in an organization is kind of like being the quarterback on a ball team. If the team wins, the quarterback gets more credit than he deserves. If they lose, he's the one who takes the blame. But when your organization is prospering, there are lots of encouraging words and ego boost that may help you conclude you're somebody special. You're above the rules. That's certainly true in ministry. We get some criticism sometimes, but there are always people who say, "You're the greatest. Would you talk to my husband? Nobody can talk to him but you. That's the best sermon." No matter how bad a sermon is, people are always saying, "Great sermon, great sermon, great sermon." Matt Proctor, a friend of mine, said he preached poorly one day. He knew he preached poorly. People still came out and said, "Great sermon, great sermon." But one older woman was a little more honest. She came out and shook his hand and said, "Nice try." But most people don't say "nice try." You get more credit than you deserve as a leader. Years ago, I wanted to buy a used car. I knew exactly what I was looking for. Looked in the classified section of the newspaper, found the car, called the guy, and I said, "I'd like to come see your car." He said, "You come over any night after 5:30 next week." I did not know that this guy who owned the car was a Sunday school teacher in a local Presbyterian church. He had said to a friend, "The next time I'm not teaching, I'm going to go to Southeast Christian Church and find out why that church is growing like it is." Well, it just so happened that weekend was the weekend he came to our church. His friend said to him, "Now, when you go, whatever you do, don't sign anything, because growing like that, they're probably real aggressive. They'll have somebody on your front doorstep within a week." Well, he looks out his kitchen window on Monday night, and here I come walking down the walk. And he said to his wife, "That guy is phenomenal." Said, "I go to his church, thousands of people, I don't sign anything. Monday night he comes to visit me. No wonder that church is growing like that." And I was saying to Judy, "Look, don't tell him I'm a preacher. I want to dick her down on his car." He opened the door and said, "Bob Russell, come on in." And I paid full price for the car, too. You get more credit than you deserve. And you can begin to think that you're somebody special. And pride makes you vulnerable to all kinds of temptations. John Edwards, former North Carolina senator and presidential candidate years ago, admitted to committing adultery with a campaign worker. He said, "I made a serious error in judgment in the course of several campaigns. I started to believe that I was special, and I became increasingly egocentric and narcissistic. I think it's what happened to King David. In the spring when kings go off to war, well, there have been so many victories, he doesn't have to go anymore. He stayed home and on the rooftop in his leisure time, he sees Bathsheba and he falls. Everybody in this room can tell me a story about a young businessman who allowed success to go to his head or to her head. They fell victim to an affair or flamboyant lifestyle or addictions to cocaine. Because pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. Now, I had to battle pride all my ministry because a lot of good things happened at Southeast Christian Church. To be honest, I didn't battle much the big head because of the size of the church. However, the elders in the church were so good to me, it was easy for me to develop an entitlement mentality because of pride. I think I begin to deserve these things. But God would somehow humble me or bring the right circumstance in my life to remind me of who I was. I'll never forget our 10th anniversary at church. I didn't say anything about it. I said, let's stand for the benediction. Chairman of the elders came running forward. No, everybody, be seated, be seated. This is Bob and Judy Russell's 10th anniversary with us. And we want to thank them and honor them. Free week's vacation in Clearwater, Florida. Well, thank you very much. 15th anniversary, I just said, let's stand for the benediction. Chairman of the elders came running forward. No, everybody, be seated, be seated. Bob and Judy Russell's 15th anniversary. We want to honor them with a free week's vacation, Estes Park, Colorado. Thank you very much. 20th anniversary, so let's stand for a benediction. Heavenly Father, we've served here 20 long years. I was crushed. They had forgotten my 20th anniversary. Well, welcome to the real world. You know, how many guys in smaller churches get honored at 10th anniversary? How many people in business get special recognition? But it's so easy to become prideful and to begin to think you're somebody special. God humbled me at times. People took me for granted at times. And I learned the importance of having the mindset of a servant, not a prima donna. Jesus said the greatest among you should be the servant of all. I'll never forget when a chairman of our elders said, look, we've got a parking problem. We don't have enough space for our visitors. So I'd like for all the elders and deacons and staff families to park at Seneca High School, and we'll run a shuttle service to church, and we'll free up 100 parking places for our visitors. So on Sunday morning, 8 o'clock, I would drive by our Hikes Lane location, hundreds of empty parking places. I'd take my family down to Seneca High School. We'd get on a yellow school bus, ride to church. Now, why would I do that? I mean, I've been there for 30 years. You think, just one parking place, right in front door. A little sign that says, reserved, Your Highness. Something humble. But you know why I did that? Because as a leader, you are the example. You're not the exception. The Bible says, God opposes the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. People watch you like a hawk to see whether you work, whether you're on time, whether you're humble enough to serve. And we appreciate the Sam Waltons and the Truett Cathys, who, though successful, manage to keep their head. Or we're attracted to a Dr. Ben Carson, who does not boast and is not rude, as opposed to... I'm trying to think of a politician or somebody running for office who is proud and boastful, but none come to mind. But a humble spirit is a key effective leadership in the long run. Now, there's a balance. It's possible to go to the extreme and denigrate the leadership role. When Joseph was appointed the second in command in Egypt in the Old Testament, he accepted the perks. He rode in the chariot with escorts. He wore Pharaoh's ring. He married the king's daughter. He took charge. And a leader does need to be respected. The general needs to have the stars on his uniform. The band director does need occasionally to stand up on a platform when directing the national anthem. The president does need to have a special office. False humility can turn people off. I've seen preachers, somebody says that great sermon, and it says, oh, don't thank me, thank Jesus. And people are turned off by that. When a leader is most effective is when he or she feels comfortable in their own skin and can lead with a servant's heart. Sir Laurence Olivier was a great actor and was asked what it took to be an actor, and he said, it takes humility enough to prepare and confidence enough to pull it off. Jesus did say, I came to serve, but he also said, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Here's a second positive decision I made, and that was I stayed with what works and didn't get too quickly caught up in the latest fads. Years ago, before my parents died, I took a nostalgic trip home, went to a lot of places I'd been as a boy. One night, I sat at the kitchen table, and I did something I used to do all the time as a teenage boy. I ate a bowl of Wheaties. I used to do that all the time before I went to bed. And it was a real feeling of nostalgia. Same taste in Wheaties, same size box, same logo, same slogan, Breakfast of Champions. But I discovered something that night. Did you know that Mickey Mantle's picture is not on the front of the Wheaties box anymore? I think then it was Tiger Woods. Because General Mills recognizes they got a great product in Wheaties, doesn't have to change, but they've got to change the packaging all the time. That's true in the church. We got the great gospel that never changes, but we do have to change the packaging. There's an old saying, methods are many, principles are few. Methods always change, principles never do. But effective leaders in every organization have to be wise enough to know when to make changes. Jesus said you can't put new wine in old wineskins. Culture changes and people get older and competition improves and programs have a shelf life. And if you don't change, you will die. You show me a church that's still using music and buildings and programming like they did 50 years ago, I'll show you a dead church or one that's on life support. Will Rogers said we can be on the right track, but we'll get run over if we're standing still. But a leader has to determine between a passing fad and a permanent trend. We made some changes over the years at Southeast because there were permanent trends. We changed from the King James translation to the NIV, changed from organ and piano to a praise band, changed from words in a hymnal to words on the screen, changed from Sunday night church to small groups. But there are all kinds of passing fads that we say, well, maybe no to. When I first started, it was bus ministry. Buy a fleet of buses and go out and just bus kids in from 45 minutes away. And then there was a seeker-sensitive movement that said only one song per service because the seeker doesn't want to sing. Weekly dramas that sometimes became little more than camp skits and artificial accountability groups. And then there are staff people who come back from the latest cutting-edge convention and can't wait to implement the latest, greatest idea. We're going to convert the world, and if we don't do it, we're going to be behind times, they say. But you know what? If we go chasing after every fad, we're reinventing church every 3 or 4 years, and we lose leadership credibility. And the people eventually dismiss our enthusiasm as just another passing fancy. I talked, Charles Spurgeon, by the way, had it right years ago when he said, he who marries today's fad will soon be a widow. I talked to a retired principal who told me that the education system had chased after so many fads that his peers just shake their heads in disgust at the latest promotion that's going to transform education. He said it began with government-mandated busing that was going to save all racial problems, and then came the new math, an exaggerated emphasis on positive reinforcement, the elimination of corporate discipline, followed by the quota system of diversity, and now it's politically correct terminology and gender-neutral language and restrooms, and now the new math. He says only the new teachers, only the naive get excited about it. He said everybody else just shrugs it off as insignificant. Thomas Sowell said, much of the social history of the Western world over the last 3 decades has been a history of replacing what works with what sounds good. The best leaders are perceptive and they're able to discern between a passing fad and a permanent trend. Good leaders are alert to changes in their industry, but they implement those changes slowly and with good communication. Fred Craddock said, you don't rearrange the furniture in the room of a disoriented person. And people are very disoriented today, and change sometimes has to be made slowly. But you can't let the competition get too far ahead, but you don't overreact. I like Stephen Wright saying, the early bird gets the worm, but the second mouse gets the cheese. And sometimes you let other people make the mistakes, and you learn from that. The Bible says, see what you heard from the beginning remains in you. One other conscious decision I made was that I stayed in one place for 40 years and I passed the baton on to a successor when it was time to do so. When I was in my mid-50s, I read a book that really impacted me. It's called Too Great a Temptation by Joel Gregory. Now, Joel Gregory was the selected successor to the ministry of the First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, which is a flagship church, one of the flagship churches for the Baptist movement. W.A. Criswell was nearing 80 years of age, selected Joel Gregory to be his successor. But the succession plan fell apart. In his book, Joel Gregory talks about Criswell had too much power, was too much temptation. He couldn't let go of the baton. And those who know the whole story know Gregory made his mistakes. But that failure of passing the baton at First Baptist in Dallas nearly split that church. And it impacted me to the point I said, we cannot let this happen at Southeast Christian Church. It's too important. So I asked all of our elders to read that book. After they read the book, they said, Bob, when you come back from your next study break, bring back a skeleton plan for a long-term transition so we can pass the baton on this church and God's kingdom will continue to go. Charles Swindoll once said, when a man of God dies, nothing of God should die. So I came back with a fourfold transition plan. One was that I would retire sometime between 2006 and 2008. Dave Stone would be my successor. He was on staff. He was already preaching. Congregation was responding to him well. Number three, in the interim, we would hire a third preacher to join our preaching team so that when I did leave, there would be two guys to share the pulpit. And number four, when I left, I would leave permanently. I would not even return to a worship service the first year. That would be best for my successor. I wouldn't be looking over his shoulder. It'd be best for the congregation to know that there was a clean break and a new leader was on the field. And it would be best for me. I could go on to something new. And for the most part, the plan has gone well. Church has really suffered since I left. They've gone from 18,000 to 23,000, four new satellite churches, and budgets increased and influence increased, 1,000 baptisms each year. John Maxwell wrote, achievement comes to someone when he is able to do great things for himself. Success comes when he empowers his followers to do great things with him. Significance comes when he develops leaders to do great things for him, but a legacy is created only when a person puts his organization into the position to do great things without him. Let me ask you, who are you training to step into your shoes when you retire or if you're accidentally taken away? Who's going to make sure that the people your company employs still have a job? Who's going to make sure that the people you're serving are still served? Or does it all center on you? I think there are four keys to a successful transition. Number one, choose and train a successor who is more gifted than you are in the long run because you want that person to take the organization to another level. Number two, set a date long in advance and stick to it. I hear guys say, well, I'll decide. I'll know when it's time. Listen, by the time you think it's time, it's too late. And you're too emotional to make that decision. Or my friends will tell me when it's time for me to step aside. Listen, when your friends get enough courage to talk to you about it, it's way past time. The wisest course of action is to take the emotion out of it and in your mind say, when I reach this point, I'll retire. And determine, I'm going to go out on top like a John Wooden as opposed to a Joe Paterno. Number three, if you're going to make a successful transition, you have to swallow your ego. If you choose and train a successor, let me warn you, it will hurt your pride at times. People will praise them, not you. They will become too aggressive or do things differently, and they will work. And it really bothers you when it works. I remember the first time my secretary asked me one day, could you do a funeral Friday, Bob? I said, no, I've got an appointment. I just got to keep. Would you ask Dave Stone to do it? And she said, well, Dave Stone was their first choice, and he couldn't. Wondered if you could. When we hired Kyle Eidemann as our third preacher, came in at 26 years of age, dynamic preacher, just spectacular preacher for 26. And he preached with no notes. And he was concise. And he communicated. And people stopped me in the hallway and said, hey, how old are you? How long have you been preaching? That kid preaches no notes. How come you still use notes when you're preaching? I'd smile, say, oh, he's good, isn't he? And I didn't mean it. I got tired of hearing it. One day, Denny Crum said to me, he said, Bob, I'm going up to the John Wooden Classic in Indianapolis. I know you've always wanted to meet Coach Wooden. You want to go with me? I said, yeah, I'd really like to meet Coach Wooden. I looked at him. Kyle Eidemann was preaching that week. And I thought, well, Lethal, I'm not going to hear people bragging about him preaching with no notes. So I went into his office. I said, Kyle, I'm not going to be here Saturday night when you preach. I'm going to go to Indianapolis. I'm going to meet Coach Wooden. He said, that's great. Would you tell Coach Wooden I said hi? I said, you know Coach Wooden? He said, yeah, when I preached as an associate in California, he used to come to the church that I preached. Well, I went to Indianapolis. I had a great conversation with Coach Wooden. Finally, I said, Coach, said a guy by the name of Kyle Eidemann said to tell you hello. And Wooden said, Kyle Eidemann. He said, you know, he's the only preacher we ever had. Didn't use notes when he preached. I couldn't get away from it in Indianapolis. The retiring leader has to ask, what do I really want? Am I here to get my ego stroked? Or do I want to serve people and for this organization to succeed? The Bible says, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility, consider other people more highly than yourself. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but the interests of others. Now, how can you do that without thinking about what's going to happen to this organization when I'm gone? The fourth key to a successful transition is to retire to something and not from something. One guy was so eager to retire, he said, I'll tell you what, when I retire, the first year, I'm just going to sit on the front porch in a rocking chair. I said, what are you going to do then? He said, I think the second year, I'm going to start rocking. Well, if that's your concept of retirement, I'm going to tell you what, you're going to be miserable because there's a direct correlation between your sense of purpose and your self-worth. And if you have nothing significant to do, your feeling of insignificance will drag you into the pit. We've all seen people retire and just shrivel up and die. When I retired, I didn't want to sit in a rocking chair. I want to have another chapter where I could do some different things. And so I mentor. I conduct a mentoring group for young preachers once a month. I've done 70 mentoring groups. And I write a blog, and I preach like 40 weekends a year, and I'm trying to do Bible studies for small groups. And this period actually has been the most joyous period of my life. I don't have the pressure I had before, but I'm able to focus on things where I'm gifted and I really enjoy doing. I discovered the greatest period of your life is when the kids are grown and the bills are paid and the dog's dead. It is a beautiful period of your life. But you think for a moment, about people who have made their most significant contribution after age 65. The Bible's full of examples. Moses was 80 when he led the children of Israel out of Egypt. Caleb's 85 when he leads a battle into the hill country in Canaan. Anna is 84 when she identifies the baby Jesus as the Messiah. History's full of examples. Colonel Sanders, nearly broke at age 65, takes his first Social Security check, begins Kentucky Fried Chicken. Ronald Reagan, 72 years of age when he's elected for president the second time. Billy Graham preached to a national audience on television when he's 90. John Piper wrote about the contributions of older people. He said at 65, Winston Churchill became Prime Minister of England, led the Western world to freedom the next 5 years. At 70, Ben Franklin helped draft the Declaration of Independence. At 77, John Glenn became the oldest person to go into space. At 89, Albert Schweitzer ran a hospital in Africa. At 93, Strom Thurmond, the longest-serving senator in U.S. history, won re-election after promising not to run again at age 99. And Piper writes, so all you boomers just breaking into Medicare, gird up your loins, pick up your cane, head for the gym, and get fit for the last lap. Fix your eyes on Jesus at the finish line. There'll be plenty of time for rest and relaxation in the resurrection. Piper says, for now there's happy work to be done. Retire to something and don't quit. Jesus said you'll be faithful unto death and you'll receive the crown of life. What Eugene Peterson called a long obedience in the same direction. So my challenge to you is to be humble, be discerning, and continue to be faithful. I learned one other lesson that helped me. When it's time to quit, quit. Thank you.